Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You're living inside a pretty miraculous tissue production facility. With instructions from DNA and fuel from what we eat, our bodies are capable of replacing and repairing a wide range of damaged or worn-out cells with new copies that are perfectly suited to our unique biological specifications. Occasionally, though, an injury, like a severe bone break, requires more tissue more quickly than we can produce naturally. Cadaver transplants and grafts from bones elsewhere in our own bodies can work, but they both come with potential complications. So my guest and her colleagues have been working toward a radical goal, cultivating new bone segments from our own cells in the exact size and shape needed in a lab, then transplanting them into our bodies, which will accept that lab-created tissue as if it had been with us all along. Nina Tandon is co-founder and CEO of EpiBone, a TED senior fellow, and a researcher in the Lab for Stem Cells and Tissue Engineering at Columbia University. She's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas County Community College District STEM Summit, and she's here this afternoon to talk about the potential for lab-created bones and even potentially whole organs someday. Nina, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What makes bone such an amazing material?
Wow. Where do I start? I mean, they support our bodies every day. They give our bodies a shape. They produce blood cells that we need. They, you know, are the birthplace of our immune system. I could go on and on. They're amazing.
I was really surprised to read that there are something like 900,000 bone surgeries every year.
That's
are
true.
These mostly for accidents?
For all kinds of things. I mean, I was. Bone is the number two transplanted tissue after blood. So everything from, you know, trauma, cancer, congenital defects, anything that requires reconstruction using bone material. It's a lot. There are 80,000 per year just, you know, severe facial traumas, just to give a number, and hundreds of thousands of ACL tears every year. I mean, the numbers of these orthopedic and craniofacial surgeries are just staggering.
So we know it works pretty well to transplant bone from, say, a cadaver. What are the potential mm-hmm. complications?
Well, the thing is, when you're transplanting cadaver tissue, you have to kill it before you put it into the body. So it's not like a heart transplant where you transplant living tissue. And so what happens is that the body oftentimes creates a scar around the tissue, or it will resorb it. Our bodies are constantly making new bone and breaking it down every day, because our bones, actually, speaking of the miracles of bones, are a calcium reservoir. So every time our muscles contract, if we need to borrow calcium, we borrow it from our bones. And so our bones are constantly rebuilding themselves. So what's interesting about what we do is that, if there's a bone that's not alive that's put into the body might eat it away and not put new bone back. But when the bone's alive and it's recognized as its own self, it just kind of syncs up with that resorption process, that remodeling process that's happening naturally.
So the idea of growing bone outside the body to be used mm-hmm. in the body is pretty amazing. You start with what are called multipotent stem cells.
That's right. That's right. So stem cells are resident all over our bodies. They repair our bodies every day. We start with adult stem cells that we isolate from adipose tissue, which is a polite way of saying fat tissue. We take the stem cells out of those and then grow them up in the lab, and before we infuse them into bone scaffolding. And then we mature those cells plus the scaffolding into bone. It takes about 3 weeks.
So you can grow the segment of bone that you need in 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea.
And you have something, what is it called, a bioreactor, which is less terrifying, I gather, than it sounds.
Does that sound terrifying? It's funny. It's a word that's been borrowed historically from these fermentation reactors from the days of Louis Pasteur making yogurt and beer. So bioreactor is actually kind of almost prehistoric concept if you think about how long we've been eating yogurt and beer. But we adapt this word for our field to basically mean anything that is a controlled system for a biological process to take place. So whether it's, you know, making kombucha or, in our case, growing bones, the idea is to make a very controlled system so that we can give all the inputs that the cells need, and then also have sensors that tell us how we're doing along the way.
How did you arrive at starting with the adipose tissue to get the stem cells rather than some other tissue that might contain it?
Right. So the lab where I did my PhD is with this amazing woman, Gordana Vonjak-Novakovic. And she is a pioneer in the field of tissue engineering. She was just inducted to the National Academy of Medicine. She sent the first bioreactor up to space. So she has had this long history of working with stem cells. And out of her lab, this is one of many projects that has happened in her lab. Others have grown bones from all kinds of stem cell sources, whether it's what's called induced pluripotent stem cells, which is reprogrammed skin cells, or embryonic stem cells, or bone marrow stem cells, all kinds of stem cells. The reason why we use adipose-derived stem cells for our starting material for our startup is because it's plentiful tissue, for lack of a better way of saying that, and because the cells themselves are make just as good bone as bone marrow stem cells. And bone marrow is just very, very limited supply. So for those reasons, we've chosen to go with this source. And given that they're adult stem cells, they sort of avoid the whole controversy around embryonic stem cells.
So how do you tell a stem cell that you have isolated from human fat no become a bone?
Well, you know, it's philosophically speaking, it's sort of the goal is to copy nature as best as possible. So this bioreactor is basically an engineered environment. And the goal of that environment is to recapitulate all of the signals that those cells would have received in the body. And that the better we copy the body in the lab, the better the cells make the tissue in the bioreactor. So the kinds of things that we need to copy are their nutrients. So we have, it kind of looks like Kool-Aid or Gatorade or something like this. It's like a cell culture media that has all of their food. And we need to make sure that that food goes very uniformly through these complicated bone structures. So that's, in so doing, the food doesn't just feed the cells, but it also, you know, if you've ever stuck your hand out the window when you're in a car, you can feel the air rushing past your hands. This fluid, as it flows through the bone, also stimulates the cells to produce bone tissue. That feeling of the fluid rushing by creates what's called shear stresses that are an important biophysical cue, which is just another way of saying a physical cue that that speaks to cells biologically. So these are the main factors that we copy. And of course, the scaffolding itself is very important. You need to recapitulate the stiffness and a lot of the protein and mineral in that you would find in the body. Those materials actually speak to the cells as well and help coax them down the bone differentiation pathway.
So the scaffolding is something synthetic, and it remains in place and bone grows around it?
Well, okay. Let me unpack that statement a little bit because we're actually not using a synthetic material as our starting material. We're using a decellularized piece of cow bone. So we take a piece of cow bone and we strip away all of the cellular material, anything that would basically give a clue that it came from a cow.
So what's left?
So what's left is mineral and protein. And what's interesting about this particular material is that we don't quite understand all of the nanostructures of this material that sort of speak to the cells. So cells recognize, these stem cells recognize a lot of these nanostructures and the proteins and minerals and take that as a cue to become bone. With synthetic materials, we haven't yet caught up, you know, as a field of biomaterials, we haven't yet caught up to being able to engineer materials that do as well as this this decellularized piece of bone, which basically just looks like a piece of coral or pumice or something like this. But someday, maybe we will be able to print materials that are as good. But for now, we're working with what nature's giving us.
You are able in the lab to create the exact size and shape necessary for whatever the procedure would be to replace bone.
Yes.
How do you do that?
Oh, this is so much fun, you know. So we get to really leverage all of the beautiful innovations that are happening across industries. And in our case, especially around medical imaging, because we take CT scans and we extract three-dimensional data from those CT scans so that we can get the exact shape that the patient will need. And we can also leverage all of these great advances that are happening in digital fabrication, things like 3D printing and 3D micromilling. And we can take the data from these CT scans and then map that to our 3D printers and 3D micromillers to make our custom-shaped bioreactors and custom-shaped bones, all fit perfectly together. And it's amazing to see it in action. I have to say, the first time I watched or observed this whole process in action with some of the animal surgeries that that we've performed to date, when you see the bone fit just perfectly, it is amazing. It's humbling.
And then, is there some kind of adhesive, or do you just allow the cells to grow together in the same way that a broken bone set properly would grow back together?
Well, we do use some minor metal fixation to hold the bone in place, but the cells really do fill in the gap. After 6 months, when you look at the data of what that boundary looks like between the new bone and the original bone, it's really hard to tell where one leaves off and the other picks up.
We're speaking this hour with Nina Tandon, co-founder and CEO of EpiBone, a senior TED fellow and also a researcher in the lab for stem cells and tissue engineering at Columbia University. We're talking about growing living human tissue in the lab. Nina Tandon is in town to speak tonight at the Dallas County Community College District STEM Summit. We'll come back to our conversation with her in a few minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Nina Tandon.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about growing living human tissue in the lab with Nina Tandon, who is co-founder and CEO of EpiBone and a researcher in the lab for stem cells and tissue engineering at Columbia University. She's now to speak tonight at the Dallas County Community College District STEM Summit. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org. Or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Is there any challenge to making this bone that you have grown in the special medium, in the bioreactor, stop growing once it's been transplanted?
Well, what's interesting about a lot of these kinds of cells is, and I didn't really know this until I started growing cells myself. I think I had this idea that cells kind of grew and looked like stars in the sky, like floating. But actually, most cells in the human body need something to attach to. There are other examples like blood cells that float around. But really, most cells in our body are attached to stuff. And that's an important cue for cells to know what the boundaries are of different parts of the body. So cells, for example, in bone, when you're growing these cells that become bone in a petri dish, they will not grow past the edge. And they'll stop growing at that point and then start differentiating. And this is called contact inhibition. And this is something that we really we count on with these cells. Cancer cells, by the way, don't often do this, which is why they'll migrate to other parts of the body and kind of grow out of control. So this property of these cells is something that's very important. So the cells don't really grow beyond the boundaries of the scaffolding that we give them.
Would it be possible, theoretically, to grow an entire bone in the lab?
Well, yeah. What do you mean by entire bone?
Like,
we are.
Could you grow a whole femur? Just
uh-huh.
And would it be able to produce marrow?
So the marrow part, that was what I wasn't sure if you were hinting at, is it's something we haven't yet tried to do. The process for which we grow bones is actually recapitulating a different type of bone growth. It's called flat bones, for example. Femurs, long bones in the body, grow by a process that's called endochondral ossification, which, if you unpack that word, basically means cartilage that turns into bone. So others actually in the lab, I should say actually that I'm no longer a postdoc at the Lab for Stem Cells and Tissue Engineering at Columbia. I am a former postdoc now. But one of the PhD students who's still in the lab, who's a co-founder of the company, his PhD research, so shout out to you, John Bernhardt, is involving and studying endochondral ossification. So maybe someday we will start actually recapitulating that process in the lab. But to date, we aren't yet growing bones to that specification.
So you mentioned animal testing,
yes,
which precedes human testing.
Yes.
What animal is ideal for comparing and speculating what the effect might be in a human body?
It's a really good question, and I think scientists often struggle with this question because we're so devoted to life and making life better. And so every time you do an experiment that involves animals, you have to make sure that you're getting the most out of it, because you certainly don't really want to be doing those experiments. And so in our case, we are studying pigs. So pigs are really interesting because they have actually face heads that are similar shape to us. I'm talking about Yucatan mini pigs, not these big pigs. So Yucatan mini pigs are interesting because their heads are very similar size to ours, and they have this chewing motion that, if you could see me, I would be impersonating with my hand, this mastication. It's almost a circular motion, as opposed to, say, if you can imagine a dog sort of chomp, chomp, chomping on something. And so since we were replacing for our first study the temporomandibular joint, so that the movable joint in the head, the jawbone, we really needed to make sure that we were copying that. And we saw really, really good results in a pilot study we did with 14 pigs 2 years ago. And actually, there's another study that's going on right now. I'm holding my fingers crossed as the rest of my team is in Louisiana working on the next round of surgeries at this very moment, actually. So Yucatan mini pigs are the preclinical model that we've chosen to go with.
So do you have to partner with veterinarians to get this work done?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and if I could give another shout out to the folks at Louisiana State University Veterinary Facility, you know, Mandy Lopez and her team are just top notch and so impressive. They have a facility that I got a chance to visit last month, and the veterinary students, the facilities there, they have everything from, race horses that are getting treated and so on. It's an amazing facility, and there are true collaborators. You want to make sure that you're working with the best people in order to get the best results.
What does the FDA want to see before they authorize human clinical trials?
Oh, you're asking all the meaty questions here. Oh, this is so important. So when you think about a drug, right, aspirin or something that's a small molecule, and you think, okay, well, what would I want to know about that molecule? I'd want to know, okay, how strong is it? How much do I have to take? How long is it going to stay in my body? And what are the side effects? And what's interesting when you think about, okay, or a medical device, I'm going to get a knee replacement. What's it made out of? Is my body going to, am I going to be allergic to it? How long is it going to last? And these, you know, when you think about what we're doing, which in a way is creating a living medical device, some of these concepts map and some of them don't. Things like, what's a dose, for example? I'm leaving a pregnant pause there because actually the answer is unknown. Like, what does it mean? It's not these cells, once you put them in the body, they continue to work and they might be there for your entire lifetime. So, so what is a dose? Is it the number of cells? Is it the potency of the cells? Is it the cell markers? And is it the stemness of those stem cells or so on? And so these are the kinds of questions that you might imagine that we're working on answering in collaboration with the FDA. We found them to be their scientists as well. And we have the shared goal of bringing good scientific discoveries, transforming those into good, safe technologies that help people. So it's a bit of a collaborative process. So just as an example, something like dose, half-life. Forget about, I talked about dose, but half-life. Okay, so how long does this last? So one of the studies that we have to do is to actually trace the cells. We have to see how long do they last in the body and where do they go? Hmm.
How do you chase those down?
Oh, yeah. You know, this is the thing, right? You know, I always thought that smart people had the answers. when I was a kid, you know, I'd ask a smart person if I had a question and they'd have all the answers. And what I realize more and more is that the smart people ask the good questions, you know, and a really simple question is often the kind that just gets you to scratch your head and say, simple questions often have the most difficult answers. And in our case, so if you think about it, how do you trace those cells? You know, there are other people that have done amazing work on creating, lines of cells that maybe glow green. You've probably heard of green fluorescent mm-hmm. protein. It makes it's bioluminescence and all of that. Well, if we can use the starting material instead of stem cells that don't glow green, if we can use the ones that glow green, then we can see where they go. So we can do that, but that wouldn't. When you do studies like that, you hope that that the results that you get are still true, even if those cells were not transfected to glow green, right? And so you can imagine there's a push and pull between trying to generate the models that can help you answer the question and then the the veracity of the results and how that would map to the original question you're trying to study. So we're hoping that by using transgenic animals and transgenic cell lines, we can trace the position of those cells. Now, if you think about what happens to the scaffolding, okay, you know, in the body, you've got bones that are constantly breaking down and being rebuilt. And we know that that process is continuing to happen. But answering the question of which molecules of those bones are in the exact same place as when we put them in, that's not an easy question to answer. But we're hoping that by using radioisotope labeled scaffolding materials, that we'll be able to help answer those questions as well. So you can imagine it's a lot of science that goes into answering some of these very simple and very important questions.
Could this technology have applications for, say, growing children who've had a really serious bone injury?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. You know, one of our investors actually had broken his ankle as a child, and I think I mentioned endochondral ossification. So he broke his ankle in the growth plate. And so for his entire life thereafter, he sort of had a mismatch of his bones. And they cut a piece of his hip out, his iliac crest, to put bone into his ankle. And so that was a childhood injury that, you know, EpiBone could have really helped, you know. So instead of cutting him apart to put him back together, we could have just grown that piece of bone right out. In the case of congenital defects, there are many children who are born with facial asymmetry or missing facial bones in some cases, and we're hoping that we can help them as well.
You've also done work to take some cardiac muscle and grow that in the lab. And what's amazing there is it also has to beat.
Yes. The heart is my first love.
That's nice. Poetic.
It really is. So what's interesting for me as being part of this startup is that I am a scientist. I have a PhD. I did a 5-year postdoc, but I am the non-scientific co-founder of this company. My amazing, brilliant co-founder, Surinder Boomaratana, was a PhD student along with me in Gordano's lab. So I was studying cardiac cells, and he this was his project at what became EpiBone. And so for me, it was, you know, the heart, it just holds so much mystery and joy for me. You got to get it to beat. So you asked me about bone, like, what do you put in that bioreactor? And so the concepts really map. You want to recapitulate what the heart would see in the body, but the heart does other stuff besides bone. And it's an elastic tissue and it needs to beat. And so a lot of my work, I'm originally an electrical engineer, involved how engineering systems that could deliver those electrical signals to those heart cells. And, you know, when I think about the first time that I built a circuit that spoke to these heart cells and actually watching the heart cells beat in concert with the electrical signals that I was delivering to them, it was a moment, you know, and it always is for me when I realize that there's a piece of technology that has evolved over billions of years, you know, aka our amazing bodies, that can somehow speak to the technologies that the imperfect technologies that we as humans engineer. To see that dialogue in real time is a very moving experience.
And is the little strip of tissue that you're transplanting already beating, and you put it on a beating heart and then they sync up? How does that work?
Well, that's how it would work ideally, but, you know, it's a really tough, difficult problem, and I don't think anyone can claim to have solved it. And so that was actually a big rationale for why I was so excited to be involved in joining forces with Surinder to make this company. Because, you know, these heart tissues are so beautiful and to behold, and so far from being able to help people. We just, you know, the best tissues that scientists have been able to engineer beat at maybe 1/10 the force of the natural beating heart. I mean, we just, the heart is amazing. And the science hasn't caught up yet to nature the way that, you know, if you imagine a spectrum of tissues, like what would be easy to grow? Okay, maybe a flat tissue, like something like skin, single cell type, flat tissue. And what would be the most complex? Maybe something like the heart, an organ that interacts with many other organs, is made of multiple cell types with a very complex geometry. Bone is somewhere in the middle. It's a complex geometry that we can solve for using digital fabrication, but we're starting from a single cell type. And so we're really at this lovely confluence between some of these other supporting technologies and, say, 3D printing and the like, that can help us actually make this complex shape using the science that we have right now. And I was so excited to be involved with a project that had the potential to impact human lives in a shorter time scale. I say shorter. I mean, we're 8 years from market if we're lucky, but that is a short time for us in our field.
We're speaking this hour with Nina Tandon, co-founder and CEO of Epibone and a senior TED fellow. She's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas County Community College District STEM Summit. If you'd like to join our conversation about growing human tissue in the lab, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is TED Senior Fellow and CEO and co-founder of Epibone, Nina Tandon. We are talking to her because she's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas County Community College District STEM Summit. And our conversation is about growing living human tissue in the lab. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to the phones now. We have Betty on the line in Dallas. Hi, Betty.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question. I have a condition that I don't have the enzyme that creates the alkaline phosphatase that creates bones. And then on top of that, I have another condition that instead of thinning the bones, makes bones very dense and very brittle. Mm. And I was wondering if what you've been talking about today might be applicable or be something that would help with those two conditions.
Oh, Betty, I'm sorry you're suffering through this. It sounds very painful. And, you know, it's when you think about conditions that involve the almost the mismatch between bone deposition and bone resorption and osteoporosis, I would put in that category as well. And we think about how can we help, you know, with Epibone. You know, there's a negative message and a positive spin on that message, which is, you know, one thing we are not doing is figuring out by growing these bones how to prevent the body from attacking those bones once they're put in. You know, so in the case of osteoporosis, for example, we can't say that a new piece of bone wouldn't be subject to the same, you know, resorption that the host bone was in the first place. On the other hand, and so I would imagine that the same thing would be true for you. On the other hand, one thing that's really amazing about what we're doing with Epibone is what can be done outside the body in addition to what can be done inside the body. So one thing that I, you know, just one factoid that I think is really striking is that two of the biggest classes of prescribed drugs here in this country, statins for cholesterol and antidepressants, both have unintended bone side effects. Whether that increases bone density or decreases it, it was not predicted when those drugs were being developed. And so as our population ages, it's going to be more and more important, in my opinion, to understand how molecules will interact with bone. And so what we hope is that, you know, maybe Epibone can be a drug testing platform for us to be able to not just understand how any drug will affect bone, but to be able to understand some of the disease mechanisms around some of these mismatches in bone deposition and resorption. And so that's the more positive, more long-term message, I would say, is that we hope that these bones that we're growing in the lab can help us learn more about the body.
So you've worked to grow bones in a lab. Mm-hmm. You've grown muscle tissue, cardiac
yes.
tissue in a lab. Can you imagine a day, maybe decades out, where an amputee could use lab-grown skin and bone and muscle, and I don't know if nerve is even possible, mm-hmm. to have like a biological prosthetic?
Well, this is certainly a future that we all are aiming for, and it's something that's in view, although it's in the distance. You know, so one thing that's really interesting, one of my lab mates while I was doing my postdoc was actually attempting to grow a neuromuscular junction, so muscle in conjunction with nerve, and it is so hard. And another friend of mine, Grace Chow, was years ago trying to develop ways to grow cartilage in conjunction with bone, and even that's hard. Now, my office mate, Surin, my co-founder, during his postdoc managed to do just that, to grow bone with a layer of cartilage on top. But, you know, each part of our body has a very different microenvironment, you know, whether it's amount of blood that's there. Just think about cartilage versus muscle, like the amount of blood, right? And so getting all of those microenvironments to be right at the same time and compartmentalize them in these bioreactors, like you can imagine, that's difficult. But on the other hand, it's almost an engineering challenge. And so I do see a day where we can imagine biological prosthetics, biological pacemakers, you know, basically anything that our body already has. I can imagine a day where we'd be able to grow that in the lab. Now, one thing that people often ask me about with respect to nerve is, you know, because we have ideas about where our personalities reside, you know, in our brains and so on. And the functionality of many of our tissues does map to the physical structure of those tissues. And I would say bone and muscle fall into that category. But when you start thinking about tissues like neuronal tissue, like the brain, we don't have the answer for where the functionality really comes from. And so I think that will be a very interesting question. And it's almost a philosophical question at this point of, you know, which tissues are going to be growable and which ones aren't.
So much of the work you've described today has at its heart really a lot of creativity. Mm. People think of science as just being about, you know, answering kind of yes and no questions and going forward. But mm-hmm. you have to kind of think, you have to learn to think in ways that maybe no one has considered before. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, are there exercises you go through to sort of keep that that instinct sharp in your own mind?
Well, you know, as I get older, I often think about, you know, what are we doing? You know, are we human? And then who are we? You know, the work that we do every day is almost adds up to the sum of the parts of who we become as a person at any given moment. And with science, you know, we're working constantly to, you know, ask questions, answer questions, experiment, analyze results. And yet we also have to maintain that distance that you get, that can often provide surprising inspiration. And that's the struggle, you know? It's like, okay, how do we go deep in what we're doing, but get inspired by what's happening in other fields? You know, I get inspired by what's happening in, you know, very diverse fields. You know, I see what's happening in fashion or in just, you know, film. You know, people are writing their own books and screenplays and getting them funded on Kickstarter. What does that mean about the nature of altruism? What does that mean about the nature of money? And what does that mean for us as a startup that is, you know, for profit, but with an obviously very social mission? So, you know, I think that there's kind of a creative tension that comes from going deep with what you're doing that sort of gets you a seat at the table as an expert, but then making sure the other people at the table are doing really different things so that you can learn best practices and get inspired from as wide an array of other disciplines as possible.
We were talking about this in the break. You have taken up surfing and you feel like it's been really instructive for you as an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Uh-oh, this is a very half-baked thought. But yeah, actually it's true. You know, I as my days become more and more chaotic, I almost view them as surfing. You know, I'm surfing my calendar. Or if there's a meeting that I'm worried about, I think, oh, is this one of those waves that looks really big when it's far away, but by the time it gets to you, it's not really so big? Or is this one of those waves that you better make sure you duck with your board to get under lest you be knocked over? And if you get knocked over, just, you know, put your hands over your head and really, you know, tuck and just and make sure you don't hit your head while you're getting tossed around. You know, I think just feeling, and then there's a sense of, you know, that comes from just feeling how small you are. And I think the ocean, you know, has no matter how big you are, the ocean has a way of reminding you how small you are. And I think that's important too, this kind of visceral reminder of the forces around us being large, but we have a place in it. I constantly find myself when I'm in situations drawing to surfing experiences to help me along the way.
When the time comes for the human trials of Epibone, surely you've already started thinking about who the ideal first patients would be to experiment with this technology. What are you thinking?
Well, I think the ideal patient would be someone with very high need, you know, because, you know, when you're scientists, you know, you ask questions, answer questions. And when you're starting to translate scientific knowledge into therapies, at some point you have to cross the divide and go into a person. And that's a very exciting moment, but it's something to be approached very carefully. You have to respect everybody's lives and everybody's pain and try and make a contribution towards the better. And so you want to make sure that whoever that first person is, that they that it's a compassionate act to implant them. And that's why these cases are often called compassionate use implantations. On the other hand, we want to make sure that we're getting that the patient, him or herself, is somehow, even though they're a very high need, representative of what some of the other people would be that would need it down the line. Because if someone is so sick, let's say that with cancer, for example, and that their healing is impaired, how well will we be able to translate the information that we learn from that implantation towards others? And so I think having a balance between high need and almost universality of the condition is what we search for. And I think certain trauma patients, you know, there's Operation Mend, for example, that helps treat veterans who've had severe craniofacial trauma. Somebody like this, who's an adult, who's suffered from something that we can treat with bones. This is what we look for. There are also some children that we, you know, patients of doctors with whom we collaborate who are missing facial bones. And some of these patients, the way that they're treated now, you know, their skull, part of their skull is resected and divided in two, and you try in the OR to fashion a new set of cheekbones for them, let's say, or take a rib. And it's very a very difficult case to make to patients, parents. In this case, it's often pediatric patients that this is the right thing to do. And so perhaps one of these patients that has grown up enough so that they're no longer children per se, it would be another potential population for us to look at.
Nina Tandon is co-founder and CEO of Epibone and a TED Senior Fellow. She's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas County Community College District STEM Summit. Nina, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks to all of you for listening today. We really appreciate you coming on these journeys with us. Thank you.